We've come to the last chapter of the book of Joshua. It's been a long journey as we have been studying our way through the book of Joshua, but it's been a very helpful one to me. And I pray that it has been helpful to you as God has given me understanding and encouragement and challenge from my study. I hope I've been able to communicate somewhat of the excitement that I find in God's Word and in this instructive book from the Old Testament. It is, I believe, God's good timing that we're at the close of our study in chapter 24 today because it's Confirmation Sunday, a day of enormous significance and decision for two of our young people, because in this last chapter we find Joshua's second farewell address, and it's his final farewell address. You remember last week we looked at chapter 23 when he called the leaders of the children of Israel together and challenged them who would be soon carrying all the burdens and the responsibilities of giving guidance to the covenant people of God in the years that lay ahead after Joshua himself was gone. Now in chapter 24, Joshua calls all the people together. One more time he wants to speak to them. One more time he wants to give them a charge, because he knows he's going to die soon. He calls them to meet him in a place that's familiar. You remember it from chapter 8. It's the place called Shechem. That is the modern city of Nablus in Palestine. It's an Arab town. It's in the West Bank, and it's a town of a lot of bloodshed in these last few years. But Shechem is located in a really lovely valley. It's the place that was rich with history, because that's where God first met Abraham and promised Abraham this great land as his inheritance. It's the place where Jacob digged his well, a well from which you can still drink if you can get into that West Bank town. It's the well where Jesus sat, wearied at the end of a long day's journey, and where he encountered that Samaritan woman whose personal life was in such disarray, whose life was so scarred and morally confused, and you remember how she was made new, and he talked to her of the water of life that would well up within her. It's at Shechem that the bones of Joseph were going to be buried. My goodness, Joseph made them promise that they would bury him in the promised land. The guy had been dead for many years. They dragged his bones all through the wilderness for 40 years. They dragged his bones during the 7-year conquest of the promised land. Finally, they were able to get the guy in the ground. And it's at Shechem, a place sacred and rich in the history of the Israeli. Shechem's a scene of a lot of drama, but I don't think there's anything in all of its history that is as loaded with emotion as this scene. Old Joshua is near death. Man, he's pushing 110. And it's clear this is about the last time he's going to be speaking to him. And here in this green valley, located in dramatic fashion between Mount Gerizim, the Mount of Blessing, and Mount Ebal, the rocky and barren Mount of Cursing, here in this place that is a natural amphitheater of limestone strata that is broken into a succession of bench-like ledges, here in this narrow valley where the acoustics are incredible and you can stand at the foot of one of these, what they call mountains, kind of high hills, and speak and be heard easily at the foot of the other one, here Joshua calls the tribes together. One last assembly, one last presentation and challenge from the old warrior. After this, the tribes are going to split up. The tribes are going to go each their own separate way and move into the inheritance of the land that was their portion. And shortly thereafter, Joshua, God's old battle-wearied warrior, is going to die. So he calls them together. He calls them together because he wants them to make a public decision like we called on our confirmands to make. But before he calls on them to decide, he gives them a lesson, because decisions made without adequate information are bad decisions. He wants their decision to be an informed decision. That's what's behind the 2 years of study. To enable the young people to make an informed commitment of their life to Christ. And if they have previously, to affirm that, to put some foundation, some knowledge to their faith. So Joshua, first of all, reminds them of what God has done. If you look at chapter 24, starting with verse 2, and just scan it through the first 13 verses, you will see the personal pronoun for God, I, is used 17 times in those 12 verses. Joshua is rehearsing for them what great things the Lord has done for them. I took, speaking of God, I gave, I sent, I brought you out, I brought you in, I destroyed your enemies, I delivered you from the hand of your enemies. 17 times, God is referenced as having done something for them. The emphasis is what God has done, and the fact that it was God who did it. Because Joshua knows the temptation's going to be that a few years down the line, they're going to start to get confused. And the victories of the past will start to become their victories. You know, we manage our memories, don't we? Sometimes consciously, but sometimes unconsciously. My kids love to tease me by saying that the older I get, the deeper the snow is I had to walk through as a boy to school. I think there's something about our imaginations that began to manage things. And Joshua says, I want you people to understand that what has been accomplished through you has been what God has done. Understand the sense of history. One of the great concerns I have for our society and our culture is that our contemporary culture has no sense of history. And as a result, we are condemned to repeat so many of the flagrant and disastrous mistakes of the past. Joshua wants them to know that it was God. Look at verse 13. I gave you a land on which you did not toil, and cities you did not build. You live in them, you eat from vineyards and olive groves, but you did not plant them. Old Joshua is challenging them, remember what God has done for you. In 1897, Rudyard Kipling wrote Recessional. God of our fathers, known of old, Lord of our far-flung battle line, beneath whose awful hand we hold dominion over palm and pine, Lord God of hosts, be with us yet, lest we forget. And that's exactly what Joshua is saying. It's God who has done this. Don't forget it. Secondly, he reminds them of what their heritage was, what they had been. When Joshua mentions Father Abraham, he's not talking about this great and wonderful and illustrious forebear that Abraham becomes in their managed memory by the time of Jesus. It is not to remind them of their illustrious roots. It is to remind them honestly of their roots. And they didn't have an illustrious ancestry. Their beginning as a people was both humble and utterly pagan. Verse 2, long ago your forefathers, including Terah and the father of Abraham and Nahor, lived beyond the river and worshipped other gods. You don't have any great heritage to live up to, Joshua's saying. You came from pagan stock, worshippers of heathen gods. The fact that you are now God's chosen people says nothing about you. It says a lot about God. Folks, the same thing's true for us. None of us, in spite of the great joy and delight we can take in our heritages, some of us, must understand that it is not our heritage, but it is what God has done. Remember what Paul said in Ephesians 2? As for you, you were dead in your transgressions and sins, in which you used to live when you followed the ways of this world and of the ruler of the kingdom of the air, the spirit who is now at work in those who are disobedient. All of us also lived among them at one time, gratifying the cravings of our sinful nature and following its desires and thoughts. Like the rest, we were by nature objects of wrath. But because of His great love for us, God, who is rich in mercy, made us alive with Christ. even when we were dead in transgressions. It is by grace you have been saved. Don't just look back in history and remember what God has done, but remember what you have been. I don't care how nice you are. I don't care how illustrious your background or your pedigree is. You were dead in trespasses and sins, and so was I, apart from the grace of God. And Joshua wants these people to remember that. You're part of the people of God, not because you're of such cool ancestry, not because of your service record for the church, not because of your religious pedigree or your standing in the community. You are part of the covenant people of God if you are because of the wonderful grace of God. Confirmation Day always brings out the relatives. Men and women who are part of other congregations, but who on this day, and I'm sure with the blessing of their pastor, celebrate with their young kinfolk this significant and sacred moment. But confirmands, when you look at uncles and aunts and grandpas and grandmas and moms and dads, it is not them that gives you status with God. It is the grace of God. Third, Joshua calls on the people one more time to get consistent. They'd been called to be God's people out of paganism and out of idolatry centuries ago. Here they are at Shechem, surrounded in this new land by a host of its native people who had yet were unconquered, among whom they were going to be living. And these people among whom they were going to be living were pagans and idolaters. And Joshua knows compromise is going to be a constant danger. But there's something that really bugs me about this. Israel was sure to be drawn into idolatry because they were already compromised. Look at verse 14. Throw away the gods your forefathers worshiped beyond the river and in Egypt. And verse 23. Now then, said Joshua, throw away the foreign gods that are among you and yield your hearts to the Lord, the God of Israel. Hundreds of years have passed, years marked by the blessings of God, by demonstrations of his power. And yet even here at this peak of Israeli history, these people are still carting around the heathen gods of Abraham and the heathen gods of Egypt, where they were slaves for generations. Talk about confused and confusing discipleship. Talk about mixed loyalties. The children of Israel needing at this stage in their history to be encouraged to throw away those old pagan gods. I think it's pathetic, but folks, let's be honest. That is a current problem for the Church of Jesus Christ and those of us who are part of his church. Ours is an idolatrous culture. We don't have very many people that I know of that are kneeling down to some kind of an image of stone or of wood. But how else do you explain our incredible idolatrous adulation of Madonnas and of the Henderson boys in baseball, for those of you that don't know that, and Joe Montana, and even in the church, some of the big shot preachers? The kind of whoa that we get involved. We're an idolatrous age and generation. We fawn after. We read everything about it. Pick up a newspaper article and they tell you what the president had for breakfast. I couldn't care less what he ate for breakfast. But then why do I read it? You see, we who are the followers of the God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, we who've been in Christ's church for years, we who may have wonderful records of service, if we're going to be honest, we're going to have to confess that we have some idols stuffed away in the closets of our lives too. Idols we haven't actively worshiped necessarily. It's just kind of comforting to have them around. Idols like affections. that are outside of God's will. Idols like money and resources that are unyielded and hoarded. Idols like ambition that's wrapped in egocentric pride. Idols like spirits which are so quick to criticize others and so rapid to excuse ourselves. Idols like an unwillingness to serve, but a great desire to sit. Idols like forgiven spirits, which are themselves unforgiving. Joshua reminds Israel, as he reminds us, that this business of idol worship is still very dangerously a part of our own lives. And when it is, the result is we are aware of spiritual life, but we don't experience abundant life. We have joy in the knowledge of union with Christ, but there's a strangeness in communion with Christ. There's a longing for feel good, but not much desire to be good. And if our lives are marked by movement without progress and by service without success and by spiritual life but without spiritual health, then maybe we need to hear old Joshua say, throw away the foreign gods that are among you and yield your hearts to the Lord. Fourth, Joshua calls them to decision. You know, folks, decisiveness is not a trait of our society. We have a nation of wafflers, and I don't care if you go from the White House to the outhouse. Everybody wants to see which way the wind's blowing before they take a stand. What are other people doing? What's everybody saying? We'll just go with the flow. Man, I remember, and some of you that are older, as old as I am, can remember how in history we learned about Patrick Henry standing before the Continental Congress and making that impassioned speech where he sums it up and saying, I know not what course others may take. As for me, give me liberty or give me death. He did not take a telephone pole. But folks, that's pretty rare. It's also pretty rare, not just politically, but it's rare religiously. We are a part of a culture that wants to homogenize matters of faith. All roads lead to Rome, like so much they do. All religions are okay as long as you're sincere. That's the devil's lie. Let me give just one illustration. Last Sunday afternoon, we met at St. Monica's Catholic Church for the Mercer Island Baccalaureate. We heard a bunch of high school graduating seniors give testimony to their personal faith in Jesus Christ and the transformation their lives had experienced as a result of that. Fellas and girls from several of our congregations here on Mercer Island. And my heart rejoiced. What a great time. I hate to miss that baccalaureate service, no matter if I've got kids graduating or not. It's just a high moment. That was last Sunday. This week, the Mercer Island Ministerial Association is beginning to make noises and to politic to take over the baccalaureate from the youth pastors of the island in order that it might be more inclusive. You might be interested in knowing that the president of the Mercer Island Clergy Association is the leader of the Mormon Church here on Mercer Island. And the rabbis, a couple of great guys, are members. And the reader from the Christian Science Church. We're talking cults, folks, are part of the Mercer Island Clergy Association, and they want to take over the baccalaureate and reduce it to the lowest common denominator. They want to homogenize the whole thing so that baccalaureate will turn out to be, isn't it nice you've graduated, be good. Instead of a clear, ringing witness of the importance of a consistent and clear stand for Jesus Christ in their lives. In fact, the statement of Jesus in John 14:6 must fall out of a lot of people's Bibles. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. That sounds so exclusive and so dogmatic, it's downright un-American. and it'd never pass the Mercer Island Clergy Association. And now here stands old Joshua, and he said, fish or cut bait. I have a very good friend that is politically very involved. He's a pastor, politically very involved in the Presbyterian Church. A lot of you people have read the reports of what kind of debate is going on with the sexuality report in the United States Presbyterian Church. And some of you have felt superior as you've read it, and saying, well, at least the Covenant Church isn't like that. Shame on you. This friend of mine said the significant thing that's going to be decided at that session is not whether we are going to receive and implement that report of that committee. It really comes down basically as to whether the Presbyterian Church is going to replace the cross on its roof with a weather vane. And folks, that's the same issue that faces us. If your spiritual life is more represented by a weather vane which turns whatever way the wind that surrounds you at that moment is blowing, then Joshua's word is for you as well as it's for me. A decisiveness. Bob Dylan was right a few years ago when he wrote that song, "You Gotta Serve Somebody." Now that's gospel truth. It came out of a rather strange place, but it's gospel truth. You gotta serve somebody. It'll either be the devil or it'll be the Lord. So Joshua says, decide. And then he gives them their options. That's kind of funny. I mean, he doesn't tell them, you got to decide like this. He says, here's your options. One, you can choose the gods of your forefathers, the gods that they served while in the Ur of the Chaldees. That's what he means by the phrase, beyond the river. The choice is to go back and serve the pagan gods of old ancestor Terah and Abraham. Second choice. You can serve the gods you served in Egypt when you were slaves. Now the gods of Egypt were the gods of the Nile, the gods of land, the gods of sky, the gods of sun. By the way, these nature gods are very contemporary. This is the god of the New Age. Or third, you can choose the gods of the Amorites. That's the people that lived around them. And in this land where the Jews are now living, the gods of the Amorites were particularly horrible gods. Gods like Molech, who was to be worshipped by child sacrifice. By the way, don't feel too superior. We are a part of a society that sacrifices thousands of unborn babies on the altar of convenience. So let's recognize we are not that far removed, nor are we historically superior to what we find in the book of Joshua. The gods of Molech were worshipped by child sacrifice, by fertility cults, by cultic prostitution. The fourth choice they had was to worship the true God, the God who had made Israel into a people, who had brought them out of bondage in Egypt, who had given them the victory. And those folks are still the same choices. It's the choice the confirmands face. It's the choice every one of us face. The choice is between the gods of nature and crystals, the gods of mythology and tradition, the gods of sensuality and human appetite, or the worship of the true God. It ain't changed, folks. The true God who purchased our redemption by the cross of Christ and the empty tomb is the one who said he is the only way to the Father. And old Joshua then makes a dramatic announcement. Man, this old guy stands up in front of the people of Israel and he says, you make your choice and those are your options. As far as I'm concerned, I've made mine. As far as I am concerned, I and my house will serve the Lord. He didn't take a telephone poll first. He didn't get the votes. He stood and made a decision, and he's still leading those people, even at his ripe old age. No majority opinion determined his morality. He did not ask, what do you think I should do? Joshua had led them in the past. He's leading them now, and he leads them in decisive devotion. He knew, and I'm sure he wanted to choose for them, but he knew he couldn't do that. Man, there have been times when I see the beautiful young people of this congregation, and I just hurt to make choices for them. Choices for them that I know will avoid the pain that they're walking right into, because I've been there. I know that pain. I want to spare them, but I can't. It's their choice, but I can stand clearly before them, and so can you, and so had you better, adults. Stand clearly as disciples of Christ. I want the young people of this congregation to look at any one of us who call ourselves followers of Christ and see a clear, wise, and consistent disciple, not some kind of homogenized religious waffler. Because if they see your waffle in your home or in our church, they're going to get confused and waffle themselves. Now, I want you to notice five things about this choice. And you say, oh, man, five more things? All right, five things, but they're real brief. First of all, choice is not a matter for deferral. Notice he says in verse 15, choose this day. You don't make a choice, you've made a choice. Second, it is a personal choice. Mommy and daddy and grandpa can't make the choice for you. Pastor Bud can't make the choice for you. Choose for yourselves, he says. Third, it's a choice for which you are held accountable. Look at verse 22. You are witnesses against yourself. Accountability. Fourth, it's a choice that demands consistency. Look at verse 23. Now then, throw away the foreign gods. Get rid of this crazy idea of mixed devotion. Fifth, it is a choice that is a continuing choice. Joshua challenges the people to choose to serve God and affirms for the people that that was a choice he had already made. And the tense of the verb he uses is a continuous action verb. He is not saying, this is something I did. He is saying, this is something I did, this is something I do, this is something I shall do. Decision in discipleship is a continuing action verb. Church, confirmands, that's the choice that we are called upon to make today. St. Augustine once said, to myself I will show a heart of steel. To my fellow man I will show a heart of love. To my God, I will show a heart aflame. Nothing less will do. Choose you this day whom you will serve. By the way, you notice that? Whom you will serve. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Imperfectly. You heard about my driving this morning. But we will serve the Lord.